Thank you all very much, and thank you, Steve, and thanks for the organizers for having me. This is absolutely wonderful. My dream someday is that all conferences will be like this so that I don't have to wear pants ever again. But fear not, if I just put horrible images in your mind, I am wearing pants. I'd like to talk today about the new librarianship worldview. My name is David Lankus. I have a job. I work at Syracuse University's iSchool. And I know the recording will be here. I also tend to put screencasts of all my presentations up at davidlankus.org, and if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Artie Lankus, or Facebook, it's Artie Lankus, or LinkedIn, it's Artie Lankus, or Google Plus, Artie Lankus, or if you want to find me on Skype, it's Artie Lankus, and Flickr, it's Artie Lankus, and on Goodreads, I'm Artie Lankus. And why I keep going on over and over is not to show you how well connected I am, because have you ever noticed that the people with the most avenues to connect them are the least likely that you want to use one of those? What I wanted to show this to you is because my guess is in your organization, possibly you, but possibly the library you work in, you've got a list like this and it keeps growing and growing and growing, right? The idea of, well, we're in social media and, well, we had to be in MySpace when MySpace was here and GeoCities and all these other things, and we still run an island in Second Life, and we're hoping to God that, you know, pretty soon MySpace will come back and all the work we've done there will help. And we keep adding and adding and adding and adding technologies and services, hoping that one of them will be the key to revitalizing libraries as we know them. Libraries have put a lot of faith in technology, and that's not just in the past 5 years or 10 years. Over our history, we put a lot of faith in technology as a means of not just better serving our communities. That's the noble goal, and it's an important one, and one I'm 100% behind. But let's face it, we've also made some bets on what's cool and trendy. You know, librarians love a good trend to get behind. You know, I was in virtual reference days. I was part of the problem for many of these things. You know, before Facebook and such, we had dial-up connections and freenets, and before that, we had microfiche readers, and before that, we were always looking for the new technology that would make us more relevant, would allow us to connect out. But the real problem that libraries have is not the idea of coming up with new ideas, not the idea of coming up with new projects. Now, we can all be better in that, and there's a real challenge for us to be a creative individual. But this stereotype of librarians as somehow mousy and passive and least and resistant and conservative, I think is a completely bogus concept. The trends we jump on may not make the top 10, and we may confine ourselves, but look through your library. Look at their signage. Look at everywhere, and you're going to find jumping to a trend, trying something. Now we've got a commons. Now we've got this. Now we've got that. The problem that libraries have is not coming up with new ideas. We can do better. We can do faster. We'll get to that in a second. The problem we have as libraries and librarians is killing them. Right? And we can make it sound as nice as we want. We can replace the Grim Reaper with, you know, a happy, fun version of it, but it still doesn't get rid of the idea that one of the things we least like to do is to get rid of ideas and projects. Now, libraries and librarians are hardly the only one to blame about this. I work in an academic setting. We hate giving up projects. You know, what are you doing Thursday night? I'm driving down to Elmira to teach two people from the IBM Research Center that closed 20 years ago because you never know, those two people need us. Right? We all have ideas that we want to start and try and incubate, and for a whole host of reasons, we're really, really bad at stopping them. Right? New projects are hard to start. That's the other thing we realize, is that it usually takes us a lot of effort to get to the point of even starting the new projects, but they become impossible to kill. Why? Tradition, right? This is the easy answer. Oh, old fuddy-duddy, old-fashioned libraries. Well, traditions, you know, oh, why do you still do the card catalog as well as the online catalog? Because we always did that, right? That may be there, but that's more of a stereotype than a reality. I've rarely walked into a library and said, why is this project happening? You're like, well, let me tell you, on August 30th of 1851, you know, in the middle of the night, that's not how it works. Sure, there's resistance to getting rid of core services or things that have been defined as core services. We see that through standing dissemination of information. We see that through reader's advisory. We see this idea of resisting getting rid of things because we've always done them. More often than not, we don't get rid of projects for interpersonal skills, right? A good project was usually started by a person or a group of people, and to get a project started, to go through the mess of committees and assignments and budgeting, they had to take a lot of ownership. And as a project gets going, if it's not panning out, or as we'll talk about, it worked really well and then suddenly is not panning out, we don't want to be the ones to hurt someone's feelings. One of the issues that we have in any type of organizations, and libraries in particular, is that we own these things. And there usually is a person associated with them. I had a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant librarian who worked for me. And I'm lucky enough to still have her as a colleague. And her baby, her project that she did brilliantly on, that it was a great project, but it just had to go away. It was not making any, it was out of money. It was out of support. It was out of users. It just had to go away. It took her over 10 years to get over that. That's a reality that as good people, we don't like causing pain to other good people. Hangers on. The idea that, well, I don't want to try anything new. I just want to keep doing this forever and ever and ever. I was at a large academic university, and they were talking about revamping, rethinking, redoing their reference. And one of the debates was getting rid of the dreaded reference debate. Can we get rid of the reference desk? And these librarians, you know, it was like, they can take it out of my cold, dead hands, that whole stereotype. And when we sort of talked with them and got to know what was going on, what it was is, if you take this away, what will I do instead? And so the answer to that wasn't to force them to show up one day and have it absent. The answer was to bring some other fabulous librarians from another university who sat there and said, I do 2 hours of reference on a desk a month. And frankly, I wish I didn't have to do that because I'm busy teaching and consultation with faculty, sitting over. And they went through this amazing list, and you could see the reference librarians going, oh, that sounds better. And so you need this idea of, you know, if we simply say it's going away, how do we bring it back? I see bureaucracy in the chat. Absolutely. The idea of we've done it, we'll always do it because it takes too much effort to stop it. But the one I want to talk about, the one that's sort of kind of scary, is that it's sometimes hard to kill a project when that project has been so successful in the past. And I know that's, you sit there and you go, well, wait, it worked, it worked, it worked. How are we going to get rid of it? Look, it got us to where we are. Look, it's part of our pride and joy. We have a plaque on the wall. How could you get rid of that? It was successful. And what we have to realize is there's a paradox going on here. There's a paradox of success. The paradox goes something like this. Not only does past success not indicate future achievement. In other words, yes, you were successful. That doesn't mean you're going to continue to be successful. But past success can actually lead to future failure. If we keep trying to do what worked in the past and not take account for the new setting, we can divert resources from new ideas, new thinking, new and better services for our community because we constantly think, well, if that worked before, it'll work again, and it'll work again, and it'll work again. And we just keep sort of trying to recycle this idea and call it new names. And I'm going to give you a few examples, right? So the classic example of this is Wikipedia versus Microsoft Encarta. And I saw Joyce is on here, and I'm sure imagine there are other some school librarians hanging out. My peeps, thank you. And if you'll recall, Microsoft Encarta, this was Microsoft's encyclopedia, the one that quote-unquote killed the Encyclopedia Britannica, even though it's still running, was Microsoft bought really a second-rate encyclopedia, then put a ton of money into not only making it easily accessible and cheap, they brought in new editors, they really built an encyclopedia business. And this physical CD owned the school market. If you wanted to say who's the most successful encyclopedia in the world, it was Microsoft Encarta. Now, at the same time, so you're looking at something like, you know, 2000, this little thing called Wikipedia starts. And Wikipedia was a bunch of, you know, programmer geeks who said, hey, let's let anyone edit something. And they sort of built around it. But it was really a ragtag group with a piece of software. And what happened was, if you looked at them as those things, Encarta owns the market. Encarta is building on the success of previous generations of encyclopedias. Encarta, Microsoft, was building the foundations that allowed encyclopedias to succeed for literally centuries. And Wikipedia is this brand new thing that just lets the riffraff in. Who would you have predicted would win that? I mean, I would have put a lot of money on Microsoft. I would. I wish I, well, I'm glad I didn't. But I, you know, what happened is over time, Encarta closed. Wikipedia took off. Why is that? Well, it turns out that there was a fundamental different underlying philosophy, which was that Wikipedia not only sort of got the idea of crowdsourcing and bringing expertise from everywhere together, but it was fast and it was nimble, and particularly for its target market, which was the internet, it was up to speed on technology instantaneously, pop culture instantaneously, whereas Encarta would have to go through this long editorial process. Now, if you're sitting there going, Dave, I've heard you before, and I've heard this example. Please stop using it. It's so dated. Let me give you another one. Here's a little company that's having some trouble. This is one of the first internet breakthrough companies of the universe, right? The idea that they started creating and cataloging the entire internet in 13 categories to the point where every library, and you know if you were around, you did it too, you had to change your front page to have 13 categories, and let's make these easy links and all this other stuff. And Yahoo has really kept going and going. First, they gave away search. They said, all right, we used to be a search company. Now we can't keep up, so we'll just license someone else's. And then they became the news portal. And they just sort of lurched from step to step and wondered why, when they lurched from place to place, right, so now the landing page, that it wasn't sticking and growing again. And what they were trying to do is anytime someone was successful, they sort of zipped all their resources there. And if that success changed, they zipped over there. And so Yahoo's had a real trouble because it doesn't fundamentally understand what allowed it to succeed in the first place. And that's what it comes down to, is what we have is when we think about a planning process, when we think about planning for the future, we have a system that looks roughly like this, right? You have a vision. We are going, you know, to be the wonderful library of the world. You have some mission. We're going to do it through X, Y, Z. Turns into a strategy. We're going to do this and then this and prioritize this, and here's how the resources are going to be allocated to finally execution, right? So there's the sense that there's a nice progression from a vision to an execution. The problem with this model is it's missing something. It's missing the fact that all of these visions and missions and strategies are founded on something much more fundamental and something often ignored that is more important, and that is a worldview. If you look at, for example, libraries as in the book business, then your vision is going to be awfully bookish, and your mission is going to be bookish, and your strategy is going to be bookish, and your execution. But if I said, was that because your worldview was about books? And you'd be like, no, it's about libraries. It's about being very innovative. Worldviews change the questions we can even ask. They open up questions, and do they matter or don't they matter? I'll give you an example. The MacArthur Foundation asked me to answer this question. They said, Dave, what is the future of libraries? Go forth. Now, if they had been nice and simply said, from your own point of view, I would have been done, right? Because clearly I know. But they said, you know, survey, look across the literature, look across the people, tell us what is the future of libraries. Now, I'm an academic, and in academic ease, the question is the most important thing that you can come up with. Questions are the currency of the realm. And it turns out that this question sucks. This is a bad question. It's a horrible question because it makes some assumptions. For example, it makes the assumption that there is one future. It makes the assumption that that future is determined, right? That we're headed towards it. It's there. It's unchangeable. It's fixed. We're headed towards it. In essence, what's behind this question is a worldview. It's a deterministic worldview. It's a worldview that says the exigent strategies, the ways that the larger forces of the world, government and business and people's desires and technology are going to shape that future, and we are then going to inherit it. But what if we change the question? What if we challenge the worldview? For example, what should be the future of libraries? You know, if I told you today that the future of libraries is they're gone, and there are plenty of places that you've already seen that, right? The future, the libraries are obsolete. They'll be obsolete. And Forbes at least gave us a date, right? They'll be by 2020. We won't need them. Are you okay with that? Are you okay if libraries go away? If you are, I think that what I ask, what are you doing in the profession, sort of managing the decline? That doesn't sound very inspiring. So the question becomes, well, wait a minute, what should it be? What do I want it to be? What's my vision of it? And suddenly the idea becomes, wait, I can help control it. By the way, I see something about libraries will never go away, they'll only evolve. But so let me ask you a peer question. What if the future of libraries is that they succeed, but we don't have librarians anymore? Or what if we have plenty of librarians, but we don't have libraries anymore? Those are possible futures. Do you like them? Do you like either one of them? Would you fight for one of them? Once again, by just changing the question, we show that we are looking at the world a different way. Let's keep going with this one. So we've got what should be the future of librarians. How about the future of libraries and librarians? Right? The truth is that when you think about it and you look at the mission statement and you look at the idea of what a library is here to do and what our vision is and such, a lot of them start with the library is eternal and forever. And then we hire librarians to make that happen. Right? That's the Danville statement. Is that it? Or are librarians creating libraries? You know, what is the role of these two people? And once again, they could be separated. The famous line about we're the only profession named after our building. No, we're not. Accountants were named after counting houses. It used to be that, you know, in Dickens' day, Scrooge, you brought your records to a counting house and they would do your records for you and send back the business. But what happened is people suddenly realized they could hire these people to work internally. They wouldn't have to walk across those windy streets. They would have the ability to have much more confidentiality in their information, and they could use their expertise to project and forecast different models. And so what happened was the field of accounting has exploded and become more and more important in modern times, but the counting houses were down to four, right? The idea here that they've consolidated, they've moved in different ways. Once again, what should be that future? Let's keep playing down this line. Now, we live in the U.S., and I know this is an international conference, so please excuse me if this is a very U.S. comment, but I know the folks in New Zealand, you guys have a democracy. In Australia, you guys have a democracy. So the idea being that at least in the U.S., but where I've been, where I visited, one of the main justifications behind libraries is democracy, that we have an informed public. We have an informed citizenry that can learn about the issues, read about the issues, be informed about the issues, be active, because we know that democracy is not simply a vote and forget. It's constant engagement with civil institutions and obligations on the part of the citizen to oversee the government, be part of the government, watch the government, criticize the government, help form the government, right? When I went and looked through this, what we found was that libraries were much concerned about what's the latest gizmo and gadget and technology than what was their role in democracies. I mean, if you're in an institution, by the way, academic institutions have at their core the idea that of an informed democracy, marketplace, and country and society. If you're in a public library, if you're in a school library, public or private, I ask you, you evaluate how many people walk into your library, you evaluate how many circulations and books, do you evaluate your impact on democracy? When you fill out those journals at the end of the day, I answered this many reference questions, I shelved this many books, I improved democracy by this percentage. Does having a public library in a community lead to more informed voting? Does it lead to greater voter turnout? If we feel that these are important for democracy and we feel libraries are important for democracy, why haven't we connected these things together other than the rhetoric of to be informed is to be good in democracy? Worldviews matter here, right? If you think that democracy simply happens and we are part of it, then why ask this question? But if you think democracy is shaped by institutions and individuals, shouldn't it be part of the question? So then we come to something like this. So the mission of librarians, and this is the mission statement that I am out evangelizing for. I put it into a book called The Atlas of New Librarianship. And it says the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their community. All right? So, okay. Right? We can debate that. The major debates around this mission go something like, I'm a teacher. That's mine. I'm a journalist. That's my mission. I'm Google. That's my mission. Right, so why is this library specific? And there are a few reasons, which is this is not enough to define librarianship. But I want you to look at it for a couple of other things. The first is it's a two-part mission. The second part is facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. In essence, helping the community learn and be better informed. But the second part is actually an ethical counterbalance to the first part's an ethical counterbalance to the second. That is to say, the improve society part. Which is there are some questions that shouldn't be answered or should be answered in a given way. When you have an eighth grader walking up to your school librarian and they say, give me the answer, no school librarian worth their salt would simply look it up and say five. Right? We use that as a teachable moment, as an opportunity to hopefully get them interested in the learning process. That improves society, teaching someone how to learn, not simply giving them the fact, is part of our mission to improve society. We see that in academic institutions and in public institutions. That it's the basis behind information literacy instruction, which is simply getting an answer is insufficient to be truly part of an information age. You need the instructional part as well. But let's just take it for a moment and say, hey, I do that. Think of the most retrograde, stereotypical, doesn't exist, but you know it's going to show up on a sitcom somewhere library with full of buns and shushing and stacks everywhere, right? Think of the most conservative bastion of old-style librarianship that frankly has never existed, right? But put that stereotype up there. Could they say that's their mission too? And the short answer is yes. That the mission itself doesn't define, once again, the worldview. The mission of libraries is to improve society. I do that. I provide access to reading materials and quality literature. Through facilitating knowledge creation, I answer reference questions. In their communities, we're a public library. We open our doors at 10 o'clock every morning and close them only at 4:30, except on Sundays where we're closed. Right? The idea here is that this mission statement, your mission statement, this strategic planning process is insufficient to truly talk about what a library can be. And we're in the midst of a world where we are changing that worldview. That the worldview, I'll give you an example. I want to change one thing in this mission statement. It's add one piece to the worldview, which is think about how you accomplish this mission statement given this comment. That knowledge is created through conversation. Now, I'm not going to spend another hour going through conversation theory and learning theory and pedagogy and constructivism versus objectivism, but just take it for a moment that critical thinking skills, the notion of someone as a active reader of information, someone as an engaged learner, right? In education, we don't talk about teaching anymore. We talk about learning. The notion isn't that I can teach you something. I can't teach you anything. If you don't want to listen, then it doesn't matter. In fact, most of my job as an instructor is to focus your attention. I do that through waving my hands around in deep voices and talking really loudly. But you're probably looking over my shoulder wondering, why are my academic robes there? And by the way, where are you? And is that a cool headset? If you're doing that, I can't teach you anything. So the notion that knowledge is created through conversation means that the learner is in charge, and there's a dialogue going back and forth. Most of that dialogue is actually with ourselves, arguing about do I believe it, don't I believe it, etc. And yes, by the way, a lot of those conversations can be quiet and reflective, but a lot of them are loud, and the more I hear about patrons saying libraries should be quiet, I really think that we haven't done our job teaching people what they should expect from a library. We're really asking them to expect a little too little from their library. We need to expect them to say, this is a cauldron of ideas and knowledge. This is the place where the future gets created. You know what? Sometimes that's a loud process. But I have quiet room over here for you. So, taking this worldview, we can come back to our mission statement and say, okay, what do you mean by mission? What do you mean by librarians? What do you mean by improved society, etc.? And so let's break that down and see how different worldviews define these ideas differently. So in a collection-centric worldview, where, and I would say this is the worldview that is still widely held in libraries, but I would say, and maybe optimistically, it is a worldview that I find in the decline. The worldview of new librarianship, of libraries being about communities, about being conversation and learning, where artifacts such as books and journals and magazines and web pages are important, but of secondary importance to the dialogue and the interactions that occur. That your true collection is not what's on your shelves or licensed through your databases, but are the people who walk through the door, and more importantly, the people who will never walk through your door, but need to engage in learning activities. So if we look at those two worldviews and we take things like, what is a mission? The mission of a collection-centric institution is that the mission of the library is to distribute content to create knowledge. In essence, we're in the knowledge creation business, but the way we do it is we give you something and you go create the knowledge. Have a good time. It's a passive, right? I see this in academic libraries enough. It's the professor's job to teach the students. It's our job to equip the professor and the students to learn somewhere else. Right, this is where my favorite quote ever, Joan Fry Williams, talks about how libraries need to be more like kitchens and less like grocery stores. Right, a grocery store is where you go and you get all the ingredients, you walk out the door, the kitchen's where the action is. I don't know about you, but whenever I have a party of more than three people, literally the kitchen is where the action is because it's the idea of a point of creation and conversation and social. In new librarianship, the mission is facilitation. The mission, by the way, of the librarian and the library can also be different. That your personal mission as a librarian may not be the same as a library. And in fact, you know that already because you've been in libraries where you've gone, why do we do that? And by acknowledging that they're different, we can begin to deal with those conflict issues. That when we talk about knowledge in this collection-centric worldview, knowledge is actionable information. It can be stored and organized as knowledge containers. In essence, the knowledge is on the stacks. The knowledge is in the databases. The knowledge is waiting for you to sort of open up your head and pour it in. Right? This is interesting. In the new librarianship, knowledge is uniquely human. It's only up here. It's completely dynamic. It changes every minute of every day. And it can be used to create artifacts that can be stored and organized. In essence, if you buy my book, you don't get my knowledge. You don't just get to hold the book up or run it through your eyes in the form of characters going blindly into your brain and say, now I know what Dave knows. When you read that book, you may know something radically different, like Dave is an idiot, or I totally disagree, or I'm going to steal that idea, or not quite. That's the internal dialogue that you're having. When you're reading a book, you're not talking to the book, you're not talking to the author, you're talking to yourself. And that means that we treat knowledge. If we're in the knowledge business, guess what? We got to get into that messy conversation as well. We improve society in a collection-centered view indirectly. We collect the stuff, the community, society takes the stuff and does something cool with it, right? Our ultimate goal is to go to the presidential nominees, hand them the right information so they'll make the right decisions and then they'll improve society. In new librarianship, we seek to have transformative social engagement. It is not enough to stand by and wait for someone to come in, to have a library, to have a school library, to have an academic library, to have a library of any sort means that community needs to be better, which means we need to get out of them often. We need to look at the impact we have. We need to say, because in 2012, I was here in New Zealand is better. And it has to be a direct connection. When we look at communities in a collection-centric view, communities are collections of users, customers, consumers, people who come in, graze, and then depart. I hate the word user. I hate it. I'm in Syracuse University where we've championed it, and I still hate it. To me, it sounds like hep chick, politically incorrect, totally anachronistic, and inaccurate. In new librarianship, we have members. Or neighbors, if you want to call them. Friends, if you want to call them that. There are people who are co-owning the library. We're here with them. We're part of them. And by the way, they, the user, the customer, the consumer, the member, only owns half the conversation. Librarians have a say too. We have a voice as a community member to talk about what do we mean by improve and better. And we're not passive wallflowers waiting to be told what's right or wrong. We're actively going out, right? In ebooks, we don't like how publishers are treating us. And I am so thrilled that at least in the U.S., but I've talked about it, I've talked with folks working on it in the Netherlands and all around the country, librarians are fed up and saying we're not going to just wait for publishers to come up with a self-serving model that frankly they're desperately trying to figure out. We're going to be actively saying to our communities and then to the publishers with the communities behind us, this is what needs to happen. This is why it needs to happen. This is what we need to bring on. Facilitating in a collection-centric view is providing equitable access. Our job is to get you to the collection and do so regardless of age and gender and socioeconomic status. In new librarianship, access is important, but it's only one thing out of many that we do to facilitate. If I get access to a really brilliant book and I can't read, have you truly provided me access? Or it's in Chinese and I don't speak Chinese. No, librarians need to be involved not simply in access, but the knowledge to handle what they're accessing. And I mean handle in the sense of read, engage, understand, mentally prepare for what they're reading. We do it through an environment. An environment on our physical buildings and our virtual buildings and the relationships we build that not only enable people to feel safe when they're doing this, intellectually safe, physically safe, but inspired when they do this. And by the way, an inspirational setting has something to do with architecture, but we can overcome architecture. I've been in some really old, rundown libraries that have been brilliant and wonderful to be part of because the librarians are doing such amazing stuff, the walls disappear out of my head. As librarians, do we define a librarian in a collection-centric view as employees of the library? The collection's our main goal. Now we need stewards of that. Or do we define librarians as those that create the library? Now, this is one where I tend to get pushback. Wait a minute. I got hired. I didn't get to make it up myself. But aren't you now? I mean, if you're a librarian and you're working in a library and you don't feel you have any influence on the institution, isn't that frustrating as hell? We create the library. Now, this is, goes back to those questions about what's the future of libraries and librarians. We have the ability to say, I want to be like the accountant. I want to see the librarian profession bust out of these buildings and be everywhere. Or I want these institutions to be crucial center points, aspirational institutions of our community, whether that's an academic community, school community, business community, geographic community, doesn't matter. Fine. You're going to create that. And you're going to co-create it with your community. You're going to get together and say, what's a library today? This amazing ability to walk into a library in central New York or New Zealand or Africa and have the exact same experience with the same stacks and the same Dewey Decimal System is insane. This idea that somehow cultures are radically diverse and crazy except for their libraries, which are exactly the same. That's nuts. Right? We need, instead of worrying about teaching people to come to some norm like McDonald's, we need to teach, to shape ourselves around our communities and let us as librarians worry about standardizing MARC records and transferring all this other stuff. What do you need to know as a community? Let's shape it around that. That's our job, not the community's job to learn our languages. So when we look at this new mission statement, how does this play out in practical means? And so we can look at things like, how do we share stuff, right? Because here's the trick. Libraries are not in the sharing business right now. Libraries are in the lending business right now. And if you're sitting there saying, what's the difference? They're synonyms. You're right, except one major difference. Lending is when you build and own a collection and you allow access to it. Sharing is when everyone owns a collection and is willing to share access to it. So here's the problem that we have. Take a book. Yay, a book. And let's say it's a popular book. Let's say it's Harry Potter is what we used to use. Now we have to use 50 Shades of Grey. I'm sure there's a much more popular book. I think that one just got knocked off the list. But let's just say this is the book. This is the book. All right? Now, the question is, if you're serving one person, or in this case four people, fine. Right? One person, they get the book, right? There's one person waiting to get it. But because we're lending it, because it's our book and not community resource of shared nature, but our book, the more people we get interested in using our services, the less access we provide to that book. I'm taking it simple. I want 50 Shades of Grey. I'm your only library member. Here it is. Oh, wait, now we have four library members and they all want 50 Shades of Grey. Either we got to go buy more or you'll be first, you'll be second, you'll be third, you'll be fourth. And we regulate, we ration access in all sorts of ways. It's popular, you're only allowed for a week, or, oh, this is 4 weeks. Oh, it's a DVD, only 3 days. But what we're doing is we're facing the reality that the more popular we become, the better service we provide, the more integrated we get into a community, the less access we're providing. That's the paradox. And that's the success paradox. The idea that the more successful we are at promoting what we do leads to greater failure in service to any individual. So what do? We do this all the time. Dave, I got this figured out. Where have you been for the last 50 years? We're in a consortium. We're part of lots of libraries that do this, right? So if we don't have a copy, we'll interlibrary loan or get it from one of our branches, etc. Problem solved. Thanks for the speech. Except, of course, those institutions have audiences as well. And so what we're doing is we're taking the itty-bitty little extra capacity we have and we're amplifying it by taking everyone else's itty-bitty capacity. And already today is usage has gone up of public libraries in the U.S. and around the world. We're seeing that those capacities are shrinking and shrinking. And you're seeing things like, well, I don't care if we had lending privileges before. Now you've got to buy a library card. Now you got to rent it. We're rationing again. This only goes so far. Now let's talk sharing. The sharing model is different because what we say is, gee, all those dots and people around that, they got stuff too. In Ann Arbor District Library, one of the members came in and talked to Eli Nyberger, their associate director of technology, brilliant guy. And the guy said, you know how I can check out a book from the library? And Eli's like, yeah. you know how I can use that system there to find out if that book's available in any of the other branch libraries? You know, I was like, yeah. I got books at home. Can't we put those in the system? I'm willing to share them. So if someone comes and says they want one of my books, the next day I'll come drop it off. Now, in a lending model, that's insanity. That's not part of our collection. We can't be guaranteed of delivery dates. It hasn't been cataloged. Oh, my goodness, so we won't do it. But in a sharing model, it makes perfect sense. The idea that communities have resources and we can share those back and forth becomes important. And not only books, but they have pictures and maps and apps and expertise. What's happening in libraries all around the country is they're bringing in speakers from the community to lecture and teach classes and share their knowledge. The idea that we can network not only and share not only things and stuff and artifacts, that's collection-centric, but we can share people and ideas and concepts and arguments, and we can share dreams and aspirations, and we can share whole new ways of viewing the world. That's an exciting collection. That's a collection that if you yawn at 50 Shades of Grey, try yawning at someone who looks at you and says, I'm into that, right? I'm just saying, it changes the world a lot. This forms the basis then for the library not as a place, not as a collection, but as a platform. And a platform built by librarians in cooperation and co-owned by their community. So what can we do with this platform? Well, we can still have people come and share stuff from us, right? Well, there's a core collection. We know that one of the essential natures of a library is as collective buying agent, that we can take small pools of resources from individual units and people and faculty and taxes and tuition, and we can pool those together to buy things that no individual would be able to afford. Still important. We know that we can build a collective good where people may not have access to them on their own. Important. But through the exact same network, people can share their own materials and their own ideas and themselves. One of my favorite ideas is a prejudice library where you can go check out a prejudice. It's going through Europe right now, right? Never talk to a Muslim, check out a Muslim. Never talk to a Jew, check out a Jew. Never talk to a black, check out a black. Never talk to a gay, check out a gay. And you sit there and you go, ooh, but why libraries to do that? Because